Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 7 minutes after 9 a.m., March 15, 2012. We're delayed a few minutes because we had a DOT budget subcommittee going on in the room. So anyway, we'll try to fire off at 9. With me today is co-chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, Senator McGuire, myself, Stedman, and Senator Olson has arrived. We have continuing work today on Senate Bill 92, which is the oil and gas production tax, and we have with us today the first of probably several presentations and an analysis performed by PFC Energy, which is the consultant that the legislature's hired through legislative budget and audit, which is a joint committee between the House and Senate that handles most of our consultants. So they have prepared a presentation today. And if Jerry can come forward. Gerald Kipps, and he's going to introduce himself for the record, give the public a brief explanation of definition of PFC Energy. For those that are watching at home or maybe listening to the committee, so they have a general understanding of who they are and what they do. And then he has prepared a roughly 90-page initial presentation. So we're going to be running this morning until 11 a.m., and then we will break, pick back up at 1 o'clock, and then finish up his presentation. Then we're going to proceed, I think. Obviously, there's too many slides for him to go through the entire thing in far too much detail to wait till the questions at the end, so we'll kind of go slide by slide, and I'll just kind of watch the clock and the flow and work with the presenter and the committee members as we flow through this. And some of the information will be in more detail in later presentations. Some of the information that you may want isn't available quite yet. They're still working on it. So again, this is the initial presentation. So we will then ask Mr. Kipps to tell us who he is and what's he doing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. First of all, thank you for the honor of allowing us to come forward and do this analysis and present that to you. So we do appreciate that. For the record, my name is Gerald Kipps. I'm a partner in PFC Energy and also head of our upstream gas practice. PFC Energy is an expertise consultancy in oil and gas. That's all we do, oil and gas. We don't do anything else. We're about 150 people globally, and our clients number oil companies, national oil companies as well, and governments. And our whole approach is to focus on the nexus between getting closer to the microphone and
I want you to boom in.
And governments and frankly, industry, because we recognize this is a government business. Governments make the rules, and the companies have to figure out how to work within them. So thank you.
If you could just stop there and I'll stop you from time to time when we have acronyms or lingo that's tied into the particular industry. But if you could tell us what upstream is. You mentioned that you're an upstream consulting firm, but
yes, sir. Thank you for that. Upstream just means all activities associated with exploration and production of oil and gas at the wellhead, drilling, seismic acquisitions, enhanced oil recovery. So all activities associated with exploration and production activities, whether they be onshore, offshore, deep water, or otherwise, we would refer to them as upstream for the record.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue.
Let me go ahead here. We thought it might be useful, again, for the record, to lay out a few concepts or declarations around fiscal terms. And I understand, of course, that the committee is well-versed. But I thought for the public it might be useful to set the stage here a little bit. So from a government perspective, we really see the fiscal system or regime design. It's really about, one, as always, maximizing state revenues, but also subject to two important constraints, and that's efficiency and competitiveness. If I start with competitiveness, the point is that it's really a global market for upstream dollars, meaning that any opportunity here has to compete with upstream opportunities in any other part of the world, particularly if we're talking about global E&P companies. So there's a competitiveness issue that is an important part of the context. From the point of view of efficiency, in terms of fiscal system design, how to not distort or distort investment choices. So it's really the interplay between those two issues, and I'll display this next slide here on slide four, if you'll bear with me. Just to make the broad point that you can have fiscal systems designs that are highly efficient and really maximize government take. But if they don't take into account the competitiveness aspect, then you won't have investment taking place. I know this is an end member case and it's a bit theoretical, but that can happen. Just as if you lower government take too far, so that it's intensely competitive, highly competitive, and that therefore the potential returns to investors are better than any other place in the world, then obviously you would lose the objective of maximizing government take, you know, for the state and so on. So our challenge, and this is complex and difficult, and you know this, is to find out where that sweet spot should lie given these other factors. So competitiveness and efficiency. And so every fiscal system design in the world has to struggle with these two issues here. Just a couple more definitional points, and again, Senators, if you'll forgive me, I am, of course, repeating things you already know, but for the record here. Here, when we're talking about government take for the rest of the presentation, we're talking about relative government take, where we're looking at total government take, which is all payments that the government is mandated in its function as a sovereign. It includes royalties, land rental fees, property taxes, production taxes, and income taxes, divisible income. And that divisible income is simply gross revenues, less costs, including CapEx, transportation costs, et cetera. So just to define that basically here. Now, in this definition, government take does not include any earnings or revenues that a government might earn via a direct equity stake in a given project, right? So it's just government take and does not include any income or returns that a government might get via a direct equity stake in a given project. The next couple slides are again meant to illustrate some of the fundamental concepts here. So for the purposes of illustration, we picked one, which is demonstrates a fixed royalty system at 30%, and that horizontal dark line there is at 30%. Point being that having a 30% fixed royalty where we vary the costs on five different hypothetical projects. Project 5, for example, is a very high cost development. Project 1 is a very low cost development. And just to give you a sense of a fiscal system design that is actually very competitive, but not efficient from, again, the state's point of view. For example, if we look at Project 1 here, again, what that does is you've got, when costs are very, very low, it also means that government take is also very low. So, again, from the point of view of the state, this is not an efficient system with the intent of state revenue. Whereas if we look at Project 5, again, here where we have costs very high, Actually, government take can be very, very high. So in that case, it's very efficient, but probably not very competitive. Let me go to the next slide here and look at the other side here. And this is, an end member case in terms of a profit-based fiscal systems. These can be very efficient in terms of generating more income for the state, but they can be less competitive. So just to give you an example again, we've got a 50% profit-based tax on five different projects, and what you see here is basically, the divisible income that's available out of projects that from a very high cost, as in Project 5, or a very low cost, as in Project 1.
You're using the word terminology rent. Maybe we should define what rent is. So,
excellent. And rent is really the divisible income. So here, rent is the amount of revenue that would accrue to the state, whereas the normal return on capital is what would return to the investor. Okay. So again, we're presenting just two end member cases and making the point about efficiency versus competitiveness, and with the results as you can see them here. Now, of course, in real life, things are not so clean. It's a bit messier. So we're dealing with combinations of efficiency and competitiveness. And that's really the challenge here. For the next slides here, we wanted to make some comments and present some analysis on basically the global business environment for the Alaskan oil and gas sector here. Just to, again, look at what is the business environment? What is this market for dollars that we're referring to? Because Alaska does not sit in a vacuum, nor does any other oil and gas sector. So this first slide, and if you'll allow me to walk you through it, because I think it makes a very important point for your deliberations, if I can say so, is we look at a group of the larger companies. So these are the so-called global majors, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Total, Shell, et cetera. And we look at their sources and uses of cash flow. So if you look at the graph on the left-hand side, if you'll bear with me, you'll see that in aggregate for these companies, they have a cash surplus in most of the regions that they invest in. And that's Europe, North America, Latin America, Middle East, North Africa, that's MENA, Asia Pacific, the Russia Caspian is RCA. And what you can see is, if you look at Europe and North America in the 2003 to 2005 period, that the upstream cash flow is far higher than the capital that they're spending in those areas. In fact, there's a substantial surplus. So over that three-year period, for example, in North America, you're looking at about $50 billion of upstream cash flow that those companies are generating over and above the capital that they're spending in those particular locations. On the right-hand side of that graph, you can see the sole area that's in cash deficit. Again, overall, less investment in terms of an asset base, but you can see that they're spending slightly more capital than generating cash flow in, it's really sub-Saharan Africa, but it's really West Africa in this particular region. Now, so that was 2003 to 2005. If we took a look at the last 3 years for which we have data, because we do not have 2011 data fully in yet, what you see is a rather remarkable change. And you can see that for these large global companies, that the North America investment area has changed radically. In 2003 to 2005, North America generated approximately $50 to $60 billion of upstream cash flow over and above capital invested. In the last 3 years, what you can see that situation has turned around completely regarding North America. So North America for these companies is no longer generating surplus cash flow or excess. It's absorbing. So in fact, the cash deficit using this analysis is about 50 or 60 billion. And this is happening because of the shale plays in the lower 48. So what you have is a very different investment environment for these large companies because of what's happened in the shale play. So, and because of that, they've completely changed their investment strategy on onshore North America, and the results are as you can see them. So we have to think about that in terms of where a lot of the capital is going now for these specific companies, including the companies that we're talking about here today, the three main producers on the North Slope, simply because the investment environment, the opportunity set changed in terms of onshore U.S. So that's an important part of the context here for the decisions that they make. Sorry, it took me a little while to walk through that, but I appreciate your attention. So, as you step back, what it means is that, and this is known, this has been discussed, but the lower 40 is really a very key competitor to Alaska for investment dollars. Now, that wouldn't be true for every company or companies, but it is actually true for these companies, and I think it's a point well made. The second, or the next slide on page 10, if you'll bear with me, Senators and Chairman, is there are several different data sets here. The primary purpose on this slide is that over the last 10 years, probably because it's most visible, all eyes were on what was happening with oil prices, but not so much in what was happening with costs. So what you see on this slide here is a total spending for the global E&P sector, all E&P companies globally. That's in the light gray vertical bars in the background. There is the oil price as shown via the Brent index, all indexed to 100 in year 2000. And then what we do is we show a cost here. So you can see that if we're looking at onshore development costs, that's the darker yellow line, again, indexed to 100 in year 2000, has increased to approximately 60 or 70% over that. So, again, so this unit cost inflation was going on throughout the period. Now, the unit cost inflation was higher in terms of service sector costs for the offshore, and you can see that the blue lines are substantially higher in terms of how they've moved. But again, to point out again that the onshore costs, whether exploration or development, are substantially higher than they were in 2000. And again, we make this point because oil prices are very visible. The price of gasoline at the pump is also very visible. Sometimes costs are not so visible, and that's part of the global environment and in the context of the investment decisions that these companies make. Again, I'd be happy to pause here if there are any questions about this particular issue.
I'll stop you. They'll signal me if they want to have a question, then I'll just stop you, and we'll have them ask the question. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the next slide, page 11, is meant to pull some of those observations together and again, make some points around costs and also to constantly compare because this is the challenge. And this underscores again that this is a global market. If you look at the previous slide here, In 2012, the global industry is going to be spending about $600 billion of dollars on E&P globally. So that money is going to go somewhere. When we look at the Alaska oil sector and that environment, what you can see, in particular as we compare it to some of the localities onshore U.S. in the lower 48, and I'm making constant reference to that, you can see that Alaska is a somewhat to substantially higher cost environment. You can see the cost that we report for new conventional oil in Alaska, CapEx is running around $17 or $18 a barrel, and OpEx can be almost equally high. And also, of course, if we're looking at the viscous oil resources, those costs are higher yet again. So we're providing some of the other cost data, again, on specific shale plays in the case of the lower 48. Unconventional, the Bakken oil play in North Dakota that I'm sure everybody's heard about. It is also a high cost play, but it is not as high cost as we have here. The Haynesville, that's Louisiana. It's a really more of a shale gas play. The Barnett shale gas with some oil, and then we report costs for conventional E&P activities in Louisiana and Texas, all onshore.
How would Alaska stack up here? You've got new conventional. If we just had conventional Alaska,
in the sense that you're now, if we're talking about infill drilling or new opportunities in the current producing areas, we're probably looking at a cost that's closer to what you see here between the unconventional Bakken and maybe even around the Haynesville or less, and we're going to report some numbers on that. So the cost for drilling in and around existing production in the North Slope is substantially lower than new conventional oil here in Alaska, and I'll present some more analysis on that in just a moment.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kappas, as you just go back to the previous slide, I got a question at the header on that one on page 10. Mm-hmm. It says the oil prices are going to increase by 450%. Do you think the price of, you're saying that the price of oil is going to go up to in excess of $500 a barrel?
That's an index price, so it's up over 2,000. So price of oil was $15, $16 in 2,000. So if we're looking at an index of 500 or five times, that would put you at about 80. So this is not our forecast. Our forecast will be that we do see oil prices can drift higher. We also see a bit of softness in that as well. So let me just place that properly. So, again, we are not saying that oil prices are going to be $400 or $500.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Just on that same chart, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our revenue is not considered at all in this chart, the previous one on page 10.
If I may, Senator, no, Alaskan state revenues are not considered or looked at on this chart.
So that's not considered a cost. I just wanted to make sure that we're not.
No, sir. These will just be really capital expenditures here.
These are aggregate numbers.
Yes. What we do is our databases cover the entire industry. So what we're looking at is global costs, if it's offshore development, for every offshore development environment on the planet, every onshore development cost environment on the planet as well, in aggregate across the entire industry. Within that, there will be some areas that costs perhaps did not increase as much, or possibly cost actually increase at a higher rate, for example. The deep water would actually show a higher cost rate change as opposed to just the offshore, for example.
Just as you do have one of your colleagues online if you ever need them. It's just difficult to interject on the telephone.
Sure.
So if you feel that, you know, you want him to interject on something or whatever, just let me know and I'll call him up. Other than that, we'll just keep with it in the room. It'll flow better.
Thank you, Senator. The next section really looks at the evolution of the ACE's fiscal regime. We're going to lay out several different sets or scenarios of analysis here for your examination. And you'll see the terms existing producer and new development here. And under existing producer, that analysis examines the economics of the fiscal regime for an existing producer producing 200,000 barrels per day in 2012. With a 6% annual production decline rate and with the following costs. And I think that's germane to the chairman's question just previously, and that is $5 a flowing barrel of maintenance capital expenditure and $12 a flowing barrel in terms of operating expenditure. And again, those are lower costs than you saw for the viscous oil or the new Alaskan oil on the previous slide.
And if you can define what flowing oil is, so.
Sometimes there are differences between, most times here. This is just looking at the cost of a barrel of oil in production, in, as opposed to if we have other factors that go into the cost estimate here. So it's just specific to a field actually producing.
Okay.
The new development analysis examines the development forward life cycle economics of the fiscal regime for the development of a new 10,000 barrel per day development for a producer without existing base production. Roughly 10,000 barrels a day applies to about a 65 or 70 million barrel field in this environment. So under those conditions, you can see that the development costs of $17 a barrel in terms of capital are substantially higher than the development maintenance capital cost as above. And also the operating cost per flowing barrel is also substantially higher. So again, this is looking at new developments that are somewhat away from existing infrastructure would not be infill drilling, et cetera. So what we've done is we've taken that existing producer scenario and the new development scenario, and we've played it across ACES, but also with the previous PPT. And we were also showing them as these fiscal regimes were proposed, as opposed to when they were, as they were enacted. So we're going to make that point in terms of both. So when we look at the PPT as originally proposed with an existing producer, and again, that's a producer that's producing at 200,000 barrels a day. It generates this after-tax cash flow that you see in the dark line, the ATCF. And I'll draw your attention to the table which shows net present value at a price of $100 a barrel, which is just over $20 billion. And then, of course, in the larger table to the right, if you can read that, government take in terms of the far right column, reaching about 60% in through the intermediate price ranges here. So this is PPT as originally proposed with the existing producer scenario. When we go to the PPT is actually enacted for the same producing scenario, you can see a change, and I'll toggle back and forth in terms of the main slide screen here. Basically, total government take went from around 60% to 72 to 74%. The net present value for this production scenario at $100 a barrel decreased by about $3 billion over the lifetime of the field. And again, just to make the point that there can be differences in terms of a fiscal system as proposed in terms of how it is actually enacted. So if I take that same set of producing scenarios into ACES, and if I look at ACES as proposed, you can see that ACES at $100 a barrel generates a net present value in that small table of about $6.6 billion. Total government take ranges from 69-68 up to 74% in terms of the large table and the right-hand upper side here. So that was ACES as proposed for the existing producer scenario. And if we compare that to ACES as enacted for the existing producer scenario, you can see that government take ended up being somewhat higher, 75, 76 to up to 82 or 83% in the high oil price ranges. And the net present value for the project also declined about $1.5 billion. So, again, just to give you a basis for looking at how ACES has evolved in terms of the changes that you will wish to make. So if I go to the next slide, on slide 18, if you'll bear with me, here we have each of those producing scenarios repeated for PPT as proposed, PPT as enacted, ACES as proposed, and ACES as enacted. So the ACES as enacted is the dark blue line. It is a fairly progressive regime, as I'm sure everybody understands. You could see below there the red vertical bars. There's a probability graph suggesting that that the probability of oil prices being within this range over the lifetime of the field, and that's an input to the calculation as above right here. So if you look at the PPT as originally proposed, that dark yellow, it was neutral in terms of progressivity, and all the changes to PPT and, of course, ACES after generated much more progressive regimes here in terms of higher government take at higher oil prices.
So if we could just define what EV is, please.
You've got a table. Forgive me, that's expected value. So that's the expected value of all future discounted cash flows. Expected value of all future cash flows for these particular projects under these producing scenarios. So over a 30-year lifetime, if we aggregate all cash flows that will be generated, it'll be those numbers or ranges that you see right there.
So then the top one, PPT, is proposed at 22, and the bottom one at 14. What happened to the spread between the two? Where'd it go?
Mr. Chairman, if you could repeat that again, please.
Where did the expected value is 22.8 on the PPT proposed.
Yes.
And then at the bottom, just jumping all the way to the bottom, ACES is enacted as 14.9.
Oh, right.
Where did the money go?
Well, the money goes to the state of Alaska and the federal government. So
these are the values to the corporation.
These are the values for the investing consortium.
Continue.
Those scenarios were looked at under the existing producer scenario, and that was an existing producer with 200,000 barrels a day. We'll now turn to scenarios where we have a new development of approximately 10,000 barrels a day without a 200,000 barrel a day production base. So this is a new development, higher cost, as we outlined in these different scenarios. When we do that, what we see that this new development at 10,000 barrels a day at peak, which, as I said, represents a field reserve size of approximately 65 to 70 million barrels, generates the results that you can see in front of us, again, from the investor consortium point of view. So if you look at the PPT proposed, this would have generated a expected value of $236 million versus ACE's enacted. This new higher cost development would generate an expected value of $12 million. This is happening again because of the progressivity of the ACE's fiscal regime in terms of higher oil prices, higher government take, as you can see the slope of the dark blue line here. And it includes or incorporates also the fact of a new development just being in a much higher cost environment. So if we focus in on that on slide 20, we're looking at ACE's. Again, how does ACE's impact upside to high oil prices, and in particular high cost development economics? Because we presented data earlier here in this slide deck in terms of Alaska being a high cost environment. We also talked about overall cost increases in the industry at large. So I think it's appropriate to come back and speak specifically to these high cost development economics that were envisioned in these new development production scenarios. So if we look at that new development under ACES, which is that higher cost 10,000 barrels a day development of a 65 to 70 million barrel field in the dark yellow, you can see that at roughly $100 a barrel, that project crosses the line and becomes at least a positive net present value. So under $100 a barrel, a project like that under this set of fiscal regimes and those costs would not be economic, and presumably a company would not decide to go ahead with a project like that. Now, that's, again, very different than the profitability of the base production under ACES, which is reflected in the dark red line. And this is one of the critical aspects to take out of here. So that's one. Now, if you took ACES and considered changing progressivity issues, actually fairly dramatically as depicted here, and we're not proposing that, but just looking at it analytically, you could see the impact on the project economics of this new high-cost development investment scenario that we outlined. So, again, if I may, we're trying to make the point that under ACES, the base production on the North Slope is profitable, it's attractive, and the issue is new developments, which are higher cost, given this high cost environment. If I could, I then would like to present a series of slides on global competitiveness of ACES again, because as we've said, Alaska does not sit in a vacuum. We constantly have to be looking at and be aware of the fact that this is a global market for E&P investment dollars, and that's as true for Alaska as anywhere else. So if you'll bear with me on the following slides, from slide 22, we're going to show first average and then marginal government take at different price horizons at $100 a barrel, and then 140.
Just stop, yes, there. Maybe briefly explain, before you drop us down in too deep into this slide, briefly explain where you got this data, because we've seen some of these type of presentations with data like this, for instance, that don't have production tax in them, and they plaster them all over the state.
Yes.
So it gets misleading. So we need to make sure we understand what's included in here, what we're looking at, where the data came from, and
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer that question, These estimates come from PFC Energy. These come from our global databases, which we've constructed the last 25 years. And there's two critical aspects. Both the fiscal structure and terms for the locality in question, as well as the opportunity set in the locality in question. You may have seen other analysis like this that, for example, takes a 100 million barrel field, a generic 100 million barrel field, and does an analysis and looks at the returns or government take to that 100 million barrel field in 60 different government jurisdictions. This does not do that. What this does is we look at the field sizes that are specifically available in those locations, not generic, that's available in a place like New Zealand. And let me give you an example. New Zealand here is not a place with very high prospectivity. The field sizes are very small. So using a 100 million barrel generic field in a New Zealand fiscal system makes no sense and does not generate useful comparative knowledge. The field size in New Zealand might be around 10 million barrels simply because of the prospectivity of the basin, and so you have to take that into account. So again, so what we've done here is the field sizes that were used to generate these estimates in each of the appropriate fiscal systems in those localities are field sizes specific to those particular localities. Whether it's 10 million barrels in one place, 257 million barrels in another place. All right, so this is much more specific analysis, that's one. These fiscal systems estimates are also inclusive of property taxes and the other parts of the government take structure as we have looked at here in Alaska. So it is and should be inclusive of those details.
One of the questions that we run into as far as definition is the inclusion or exclusion of the private royalties, for instance, in North Dakota,
right,
with the private subsurface. Some calculations take in the royalty, some leave it out and put the royalty as an expense.
Right.
Instead of the government take, so could you clarify how it's handled here?
In all cases, we include royalty, and I think it's useful to make a particular comment right here, because a previous slide showed a comparison point to a number of shale plays in the lower 48. So there, even when the royalty accrues to private landowners, we consider that part of the quote-unquote government take because that was not available to the investing consortium. And so we followed that rule here as well. Just so you know, and the reason why this is a very important point, but mostly for the lower 48, is that in most other parts of the world, you really don't have oil and gas activity taking place on private land. In fact, in the United States, the shale play, 97% of shale play production activity is on private land, 97%, not federal land, private land. So that is a big issue, but it's mostly just the onshore 48, which is fairly unique with respect to the rest of the world. Thank you for that question. So if I could repeat, what we've done here is we have done specific analysis in each of these localities that uses costs, field sizes, and fiscal tax structure specific to those localities, and that is what's aggregated here. So it is not used generic field sizes and generic costs. We think this is probably a much better measure of what actually happens in these jurisdictions. Several additional things. OECD countries are labeled in the yellow, just for comparison points. As an observation, you can see generally, for a set of reasons, OECD countries generally have lower government take, versus non-OECD countries generally have higher government take, which is just a broad observation. There's obviously other factors that vary here. This has to do with overall tax policy. The purpose of the oil and gas sector, is it designed or set up to generate revenues for a government, or is it designed to create energy feedstocks for an economy? So having said all that, now we finally get to, well, what is this slide actually telling us here? Just to show you that in the red, if we look at the existing producer in the Alaskan ACES environment, and that's the producer with an existing 200,000 barrel a day field with the costs as we've outlined previous, versus a new producer, if you will, for the new development production scenario. That's a 10,000 barrel a day production, implying about a 65 million barrel field. That's where those fall out in terms of government take relative to these other tax regimes at $100 a barrel.
So we had, as I recall, we had a lot of work done previously in comparisons with the North Sea and other regimes, one of which, again, was the North Sea, which looks like Norway is fairly close to existing producers, just a little higher at $100 a barrel?
Yes, in this particular examination, Norway is almost squarely in the middle between the existing producer and the new development production scenario for Alaska.
Okay. And we've also had testimony that the existing production government takes should range somewhere between 70 and 75%. So this looks like it falls right in at 73.
It does. I will make a comment for Norway or about Norway, just to keep in mind, and I apologize if I may be overcomplicating here, but it's important. Norway, as you can see from an OECD country, is a bit of a standout just by virtue of comparison with the other regimes that we have here. And a big reason for that is that in Norway, in addition, you have basically two national oil companies or interests that also have equity stakes in the oil and gas produced on the platform, so that the state is generating additional income via the national oil companies owned by the Norwegian state also here as well. That's over and above the government take calculations that you have. So now what does that mean? It means that that there are other factors at play here, for example, competitiveness, as we discussed. How many operators do you have investing? Do you have a national oil company? If Alaska had a quote-unquote state oil company, that would be over and above these issues. And so I'm just pointing out there are some other factors at work here as well that are not extant on this particular slide, but you want to keep that in mind.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we brought up Norway, there is a lot of exploration out there. Why don't you have, for some of these countries, existing producing and new developments such as Norway?
We certainly can or have. That would double the size of this graph, that's all. So it gets to the point where we lose the ability to show that. But we certainly can and have data on all these specific project sizes.
You can get back to the committee and just run one with existing production and then run another one with the new development. So we have a new development slide, so then the committee members can look at that.
We can do that. I will just add, Mr. Chairman, that that what we could do is we could run what it looks like at 200,000 barrels a day and what it looks like at 10,000 barrels a day with the following caveats. In some cases, in these particular locales, there are no 200,000 barrel a day fields. And again, this is about making the analysis as specific as we can. In another case, in the Norwegian case, a 10,000 barrel a day development offshore in the Norwegian operating environment would actually not be economic as a standalone development. It would only be economic as a one well tie back to an existing platform. So I'm just suggesting that the applicability of the exact same field sizes as done here for Alaska might be a little bit less. But if you so wish, what we could do is we could go design some specific analysis that's appropriate to these other locales and reflect reality on the ground that might give us a bit more illumination on this.
Yes, we'd like to try to keep it as reality-based as possible.
I thought you would say that.
And then also explain, if you could, I think, Senator Hoppin, you were done with your question? Or?
Yes, I was.
Okay, thank you. Explain how you deal with, like, for instance, Texas with all the little stripper wells pumping 10 barrels a day or however many, average 15 or whatever their average is. I don't recall offhand, but it's some number down in that range. How that works into your chart here where you've got where you deal with Texas.
Again, each of these lines we could probably, particularly in the U.S. case, we could probably present, 20, 30, or 40. The U.S., after all, in terms of the onshore U.S., is probably one of the most complex sets of applicable tax regimes, just because you have the private land versus the state land, federal land, et cetera. So, but if we did that, and you can see some of the breakouts here, you see the U.S., North Dakota, the Bakken, you have the U.S., Louisiana conventional, having government takes around 60%. Generally, what would happen here is if we had a stripper well in Texas on somebody's private land, the truth is that often the fiscal terms on the private land is actually steeper or tougher for investors than it is on public lands. Again, assuming that the opportunity set is nearly the same. So in Texas, we might have a situation, for example, on King Ranch, where all that's private land, we may be looking at government take in excess of 50 or 60%. So again, in the lower 48, as it turns out, usually fiscal terms on private land, royalties, et cetera, are usually higher than that we see on the state or federal lands. Okay.
Senator Egan.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. To follow up on your question, how about a small well in Alaska with an existing producer, and how would that look?
Sure. Well, the let me answer that first generally, and then we may have to come back specifically on that for you, sir. Generally, if you allow me, I'm going to go back a bit here to slide 20. Generally, a single well, which would be probably an infill well that is tied back to existing infrastructure, so it's very close to existing activity, so the infrastructure is already there. It's not a standalone development. Or it could be one of the companies going back and re-entering an old well or reconstructing an old well. Some of the original producing wells are now 35, 40 years old. And they go back in with a coil tube drilling rig, which is lower cost. Those kind of projects can generate returns, as implied on that dark red line for ACE's base production. Those sorts of projects are very profitable, or relatively profitable, and that would give you a rate of return or a government take of around 70%, as described here for the Alaskan existing producer. And that's really what we're trying to capture. And again, if I could make a high-level comment again, and going back to the slide 20, if you'll permit me, and I apologize for jumping around so much. In terms of existing production and investing in existing production, infill wells drilled, replacing old wells. These are very profitable projects for the companies. It's the issue, if I could, is with respect to really new development projects, which are higher cost, that are somewhat away from existing infrastructure per se. That's the challenge under ACES. So under ACES, investing in existing base production is quite profitable. The challenge is new higher cost production, if I could summarize.
We're going to take a, before we go on to the next slide, we're going to take just a, like a 3 minute at ease just to let people stretch and give Mr. Kepis time to, you know, just take a quick break. And then we're going to reconvene. Again, don't run off because we're not going to burn the clock. We're going to stay on schedule. We're at ease. We'll come back on the record and continue our presentation with PFC Energy. We're on page, I think, 23 of this presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, going to slide 23. Here we're, again, looking at average government take at $140 a barrel. And you can see, again, given the progressivity of the ACES tax structure, that relatively in comparison to these other jurisdictions, that the U.S. ACES for the existing producer, as well as the new development production scenario, both have moved up to a point where they're actually both now at a higher government take than Norway, just to use that as a as an example or comparative point. If I go to marginal government take, and this is, and I apologize if I'm saying things you already know, but here we're just looking at a given level, when the price of oil increases $1 a barrel more, what is the difference in government take or investor take over that next dollar? So here, on a marginal take basis, you can see at $100 a barrel that the U.S.-Alaska ACES for the new development scenario and the existing producer are even higher relative to the other jurisdictions that we have analyzed here as well.
We had previous testimony in another presentation or comments made that I think it was Argentina had 100% at $60 plus.
Yes.
You want to comment on that and why anybody would invest in Argentina if there's a 100% marginal take, because apparently they are.
Yes. What I would say about Argentina is that as a result of export tariffs that they put on, several other factors that are actually more complicated or complicating the fiscal structure, basically they have created an environment where there's very little investment taking place. So it can have a 100% government take, as we've discussed, but the result is that's, if I looked at where we start off here today, that's the most efficient from a maximization of government take, but it is non-competitive, and as a result, investment in Argentina has fallen off rather dramatically. And there are major political battles underway in Argentina right now because of this reason. I don't know, Janik, I don't know if you'd like to say a bit more about that, but that's an example of highly efficient from a government point of view, 100% government take, but almost no investment right now.
Mr. Mayor, if you could, Janik, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then help your colleague, please, with the question on Argentina.
Certainly. Janik Mayer from PFC Energy, joining from our offices in Washington, D.C. I would certainly agree on that point with everything Jerry said, I would want to go back and check in the way that we've represented things here to make sure that that one particular aspect, which is sort of peculiar to Argentina, which is the export tax, that essentially limits exported oil to a particular fixed maximum price level, is accurately represented there in terms of marginal take. But that's correct. Investing in Argentina under that export tax regime is very undesirable, and we've seen the impact of that on investment levels.
Okay, and thank you. And there does seem to be some relationship between the prospectivity of regional basins and how their structure is. So if you could, on this chart here, you have Ireland at the bottom. Does Ireland, like Greenland, do they have a lot of oil or a little oil?
Well, the Irish have a lot of things, but not much oil, I must say. And that's another factor that's not well represented, which is what about prospectivity? Because that's a huge issue here. Generally, the lower government take systems, generally, are places where prospectivity is poor. So in order to attract investment dollars, to attract companies to come in and invest and take what would be higher risk, if we're talking about exploration, those governments have to offer some of the best fiscal terms available to investors on the planet because prospectivity is poor. So that's definitely the case of Ireland. If we talk about Greenland, for example, Greenland is another place. It's a frontier play. There is no commercial production to date. That's obviously a very different situation than what we have here in Alaska. In Greenland, as I said, this is a frontier play. We've had one company actually just go out and drill seven dry holes offshore in a very expensive operating environment. But it did so because it was attracted to very low government take terms that it felt that warranted the risk that it was going to take. Oftentimes, it doesn't work out. So you can generally say that the higher government take regimes have better prospectivity or substantial existing reserves already known in place, but at a minimum have known or existing commercial production. And again, on the opposite side of the spectrum, you might have situations where there is no or little existing commercial production, and therefore government take has to be sweetened substantially in order to attract these investment dollars.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If we move on here to to slide 24 here, where we showed marginal government take at $100 a barrel. And then if we look at slide 25, marginal government take of global fiscal regimes at $140 a barrel.
So we're not the highest in the world? It's another thing that's been in the press a lot. Alaska's the highest in the world government take. Marginal government take doesn't appear that that's the case.
In fact, if you look at slide 25, you can feel quite justified in awarding that to the government of Turkmenistan. So.
Well.
You are not the highest. That is not factually correct. The next set of slides basically is another way of looking at progressivity, and we're just looking at the marginal less the average take for these same regimes. So if you look at slide 26 with me, you'll see that, for example, Colombia at the top, that there's quite a bit of progressivity, and again, the calculation is just looking at the difference between marginal and average take. So you can see in Colombia, this is a highly progressive regime in terms of the impact of higher oil prices on government take. And next to Columbia, or just underneath that, is the progressivity that's embedded in the current ACES program, as you can see, for the U.S.-Alaska ACES for the existing producer scenario.
So reading this chart, is it correct then to interpret the ones on the bottom half to be a regressive system, that as prices go up, their percent of the pie goes down?
A regressive system, as prices go up, a greater proportion of that divisible income goes to the investor.
And then if we wanted to manipulate the upper part of this graph, we could do that by changing our base rate and our slope. For instance, if we have a very steep progressivity, we widen that spread or increase those bars. If we want to shorten those bars up, we can lower progressivity and increase our base rate, keep our cash flow the same, and drive that closer to the zero.
Yes, you could. And also, Janik, if you want to add additional comments at that point, but yes, you could.
Janik, do you have anything any comments on page 26, please?
I'd add to Jerry's comments about Colombia. Colombia is, as you can see, a very progressive regime, but it's progressive on a much lower base rate of government take. I think if we looked at one of the previous slides on the average rate of government take, Colombia is actually sort of, I think, in the bottom half of the pack. So that just looking at progressivity in this sense captures only one part of the equation, Mr. Chairman. One also needs to consider the basic level of government take and where progressivity sits in relation to that. And as we've seen, Alaska government take is, relatively speaking, particularly by contrast to the OECD high, and then progressivity is significant as well.
We have a question by Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, since this committee and what we're trying to do is encourage new development, get more oil in the line, there seems to be a big spread between new development and existing producers for the U.S.-Alaska under ACES. And I'm wondering, does that same disparity exist among some of the other oil-producing countries in new development versus existing? And I wonder if we could get that to see where we are in comparison to those countries under a new development. So I think that might be interesting, Mr. Chairman.
We can have that prepared along with the other slides. It's a similar information.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, if I may address that.
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to point out a couple of things. The distinction that we have drawn on this slide between existing production and new development is one that's particularly important for Alaska and I would say much less so for most other regimes that we would look at. And that's in particular because of, for instance, the impact of the deductibility of capital expenses and then the production tax credit. So when we're looking at a new development in this context, we're looking at a new development essentially for a new producer with no prior production, as my colleague Jerry Kappas has said. And for a producer like that, when one starts the initial act of capital spending, one can get capital credit, one can get net operating loss credit, but one has no production base against which to write off those amounts. And that's the principal difference why government take, for instance, is significantly higher in that case for a new development than it is for an existing producer. And it's because government take is higher for, relatively speaking, for the new producer, but marginal take is the same for both, that we see that difference in the progressivity that they each face.
Okay. And just for the committee's information, Ms. Mayer will be here. He just wasn't able to make it this week, so he'll be here in person in future presentations. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Okay. The next slide, slide 27, shows the same analysis but at $140 a barrel. And you can see several tax regimes that are actually even more progressive. And you can see Turkmenistan again demonstrating its leading role in this particular analysis. Once again, actually, if you compare that to countries or regimes in the lower portion of the slide to the left, Bolivia, U.S., Texas, Haynesville, et cetera. Really, a lot of the, or all of the lower 48 regimes where we have suggested that a lot of the capital is flowing now are regressive regimes. So that as price goes up, more of that divisible income goes to the investor consortium. And this is really what we're competing with here, among other factors. And so that's another big takeaway from this particular part of the analysis.
Well, if we just stop there for a minute, and we haven't really, or we haven't mentioned the difference in the structure between Alaska, not only in ownership, but in the structure. My understanding is most of North America is on tax and royalty, where Alaska's got a hybrid system, a tax and royalty plus a concession system.
That's correct, sir.
And could you explain to the public what you just did?
Yes, Chairman. Even in the lower 48, you do have leases. And as I said, if we take the shale play, 97% of that activity is actually on private land. So this is taking place per lease or leasehold agreements with private landowners. So each of those land holdings could have a slightly different fiscal structure. They could have higher royalties, they could have lower royalties, et cetera. They could treat the costs in a slightly different way. So it's actually, you know, quite complex here. But so what the lower 48, by the way, does not offer is private landowners do not offer capital credits, for example. So there's no role that they play, a la as the case here with the state, where they're actually incenting companies to make substantial investments. It's also true that the nature of those investments, tend to be much less. A lot of the activity is very incremental. So on someone's private land holding, we're not talking about a $10 billion investment. It could be $10 billion over 20 years over a very large area that could potentially involve 2,700 private landowners, but the nature of how that investment is structured is also quite different. So you do have a royalty and tax regime in both places. You do have concessions up here versus leases there. The time frames are much shorter. They can be 6, 7, 8, 10 years. They also have conditions for those leaseholds that investment has to take place within a certain period of time. If you don't drill a well on a lease after a certain period of time, it reverts back to the landowner. So that landowner could lease that acreage out to somebody else. So you have substantial relinquishment provisions to ensure much more asset liquidity. And also to ensure that a company in the lower 48 cannot sit on acreage and not invest. That's not an option. So the nature of the duration of the leasehold agreements is, again, different than what you have here in terms of your concession agreements. That's pretty important. Other factor is because these are private landholders, the size of the leases are usually substantially less than what you might see here on the North Slope, for example. So that's another factor. So, and again, just to think about a private land holdings in Louisiana, you could have hundreds of landowners involved in a play size that was similar to what you have here with the footprint for the North Slope. So that's another fairly substantial difference as well. Janik, do you want to add additional thoughts or comments on this, too?
Mr. Mayor, do you want to have any comments on this particular subject?
Mr. Chairman, nothing further to add.
Okay. Chairman? Yes, Senator Thomas.
If I could, since you're talking about the harvest situation, we've, for some time, the decline has been in place. And then ACES comes along, and now we're blaming ACES for the lack of reinvestment, even though there was reinvestment over the years, but it was not enough to actually have any significant impact on the decline. Is it simply that it's a timing situation here, that we got to the point where there started to be some concern over the age of the facilities at Prudhoe Bay and the constraints on some of those facilities, as well as the pipeline situation that has arisen that caused the industry to start maybe looking at projects that would reverse that decline or flatten it out, and then ACES happens to come into place at almost that same time that we're thinking. Could it be that kind of a unfortunate set of timing?
Well, I'm not in a position to comment on the political process at that time. So my comments, which I'm sure have an impact on this, but let me respond to a couple of your questions one by one. I think it's safe to say that if we use decline rates here, probably the natural rate of decline on the North Slope is around 15% per year. So what we have here is a decline of roughly 6% a year. So what we're looking at is a certain amount of investment between that 15% decline rate and the 6% decline rate. And a lot of that investment is going to replacing old infrastructure or old wells that now have 30-year-plus lifespans. My understanding, again, talking to people who worked on the North Slope in the 1970s, was that nobody envisioned or imagined that those wells would be producing for longer than 30 years. So a lot of what you're doing there, and we can call it renewal capital for lack of a better term, a lot of that capital is actually replacing iron in the ground and processing capacity and evacuation capacity that is simply past its planned lifetime. So a lot of that capital is actually going into things that do not generate new production, that just simply maintain or maintain a decline rate. So between that 15% decline and the 6% decline, there's actually a lot of capital that goes in there. So to me, I think the question is, do we want to, and if you'll allow me to say we, as part of the state of Alaska, does the state of Alaska wish to increase production above 6%, that 6% decline rate? Does it want to try to flatten production decline rate, et cetera? That seems to be the challenge. So now the second part of your question is the timing. Why is it happening right now? Well, part of it is we're looking right about 35 years, a little bit less in some cases, a couple of years longer in other cases. So we are really right at the edge of a lot of capital equipment needing to be replaced. So that there is a timing issue as well here. I think the other aspect is, and it varies from place to place, but we are now 35 years into the production life of this basin. From a simple maturity factor, there is a limited number of things that could be done at this point, and those represent higher and higher cost things. So that's a fact as well, and that would appear differently now than it did 20 years ago, for example. The other countervailing factor is, of course, we've had real improvements in production technology over the years. I mean, I know that that's clear and obvious to everybody, but there are things that can be done with production technology that in the industry we thought about 20 years ago, but we were just not able to make it commercial. So those tend to be higher costs as well, as it turns out. But they're at least available to us in a commercial application. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. So I think it's safe to say that each, and I'll say generation, but every, 10 years, with the availability of new technologies, but also as the resources continue to mature, that the investment proposition looks different. And as an investor consortium, my other, if I can put my oil company hat on, my other investment opportunities look different as well. And one of the slides we showed earlier this morning was with respect to what had happened in the lower 48, just so this massive shift of capital, in this case really from West Africa, and in part Alaska, to the lower 48. And again, that driver was just not present 10 years ago, just as an example. So timing is an issue. And again, I would not conclude that that ACE is responsible for everything at all. Instead, we're trying to say that maybe possibly in a more nuanced way that ACE is a very appropriate regime if you want a harvest area, because for every barrel that's produced, the government's getting a bigger piece of it. And for existing production, the production base, it's also profitable for the oil companies. So except for the fact that the oil production continues to decline and its longer-term impacts, everybody's happy. Per barrel, the government's getting a lot more. In terms of the existing mature fields, it remains profitable for those companies to invest in those fields. So in that case, ACES works for this as a harvest area situation. Right? So the situation would be, do you want a different result? Do you wish to treat all or parts of it in a different fashion to make it a growth area? And then other changes would accrue. I hope that answers the question, Senator.
It does. Thank you.
Okay. And just for the committee's information, I've had some data put together, historic data from Ledge Finance gathered it up, and I delivered that to PFC. That goes back to the beginning of the basin, and we'll take a look at some of that later on to just kind of get a feel for the value of our basin and what funds came in to the state in a government share. Rough calculation historically, so we'll be looking at that over the next couple of weeks. And also there'll be presentations parsing out the current production. Mr. Kepis had mentioned that this 14-15% natural decline rate, what was the increment is being spent to keep it just to 6%, which is 5-6 where we're at roughly today, somewhere in there, four. And then what's it going to take to incrementally get that to zero or plus one or minus one? So we're going to parse that stuff out and try to measure the impacts relative to current production and then the increments and have that dialogue here in the table. And then after all that, then we could have some discussion on policy. What do we want to do and how do we want to get there? Is kind of some of the logical steps. And I'm interested in, of course, feedback from all the committee members on what they would like to hear or go over. But we're those two presentations are being put together as we're speaking. Some of the information might even be coming attractions in today's presentation. But we'll be drilling into a much deeper level into the subject matter. So we're just laying the foundation. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand what you say about ACE is in harvesting mode in your first bullet point, but in your second bullet point you talk about inhibiting development for new projects, specifically the second and fourth paragraphs there. Are there recommendations to address those two points that you might make? Maybe have a different tax structure for new projects?
Yes, in subsequent slides, we've laid out different ways to approach that issue with their positives and negatives. As it turns out, there's no positive without a negative. Otherwise, this would have been addressed a long time ago. But we've laid that out. PFC Energy has not yet made a specific recommendation as of yet. And at this point, I understood that we were just laying out the template of analysis that we would use, the options or menu options that you could take.
And just for the committee's information, I have also delivered to PFC Energy the packet of information dealing with a tax holiday that one of our colleagues, Senator Wagner, had worked on at the Resources Committee. So they have that, and they're working on that. They're also not quite ready in the presentation with the $10 allowance that's in the current bill. So they're working on that. So we'll have that as a subject coming back in with not only what's in the bill, but the options that the committee members may think of and want to work on, or the one that was delivered up from Resources, or new ideas that PFC Energy might want us to consider. So we're basically open for concept discussions. But we'll have that as a subject in and of itself in hearings. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's my question.
Okay, go ahead and continue, please.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and I may have misspoke, we have not completed our analysis on the gross minimum tax. We have completed our analysis on the $10 new oil allowance, which we'll show that with your forbearance.
Okay. So, yeah, there was some confusion in earlier.
My apologies, sir.
That's the allowance will be done, so we can have that up on the screen, and then it's the floor that's not completed yet. Yes. Well, the floor subject matter, again, we got to remember is in flux as we change things within the system. It'll change that impact on the floor, so we'll deal with that when we get there. It's probably one of the last items that we work on here is what I would assume, because it just in the logical sequence of putting the mosaic together. But go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We turn our attention to slide 29, and I'll ask my colleague Janik to join us as well.
Have we completed slide 28?
My apologies. I'm a little too quick on the draw here. Keeping our attention on slide 28, and you've seen the graphic previously in the presentation. The graphic shows ACEs in the dark red as it applies to base production, and ACEs as it applies to new development in the dark yellow. And we're comparing the progressivity in ACEs compared to that which would be the case in a neutral regime or in a regressive regime in the dashed lines colored appropriately. So at this point, our conclusion is, and that's laid out here in the text, that ACEs appears to work well as a harvest regime. From the point of view of the state, you're getting maximum rent from each barrel as the production base declines, but from a per barrel basis, your state take is very, very high, so it has that efficiency aspect. And also for the existing mature fields, they remain profitable for those operators. So it's still profitable for those operators, investors, to invest in their existing mature fields, including the capital required to achieve that 6%. And it was in that context that I spoke about the 15% roughly natural decline versus the capital that was required to take that to 6%. So, again, if we're looking at it as a harvest regime, as a sector in harvest, on that basis, it works for the state. on a per barrel basis and worked for those investor consortium. Where we think that ACES does not work as well is when it comes to the development of new projects, which are higher costs as we've laid out. Because of that, it doesn't enhance the possibility of further lowering the decline rate or even actually reversing decline here. It's not progressive with regard to costs, and we wanted to emphasize that high costs for these new developments away from existing infrastructure is a major issue here. Right now, the existing system of capital credits appears to do more to encourage renewal capital spending than it does new production spending. And again, I used the term renewal capital for the capital that's going into replacing old facilities because they're past their useful lifespan here. So, and again, if you look at the dark yellow line here on the graphic in front of you, you know, because we're dealing with high cost projects, that basically suggests for the size of project we modeled, which was 10,000 barrels a day and 65 million barrels of reserves, at $100 a barrel, that's break even. So this was our assessment, at least of this aspect of ACES. Janet, would you like to make any other further comments to the committee here?
Mr. Mayor?
On this particular slide, no, but I think if we are about to progress to the next slide, I will have some comments to make, I'm sure, about the ways in which one might go about addressing this.
Okay. So if I may, Senators, Mr. Chairman, on slide 29, if you accept our analysis of ACES that it's working well in terms of the treating these assets as a harvest area, but it has challenges when it comes to growth assets or the higher cost new developments, we laid out three broad approaches that could be used to address that. Each of them has advantages and disadvantages. Turns out there's no free lunch here. If we get into uniform lowering the government take, the implementation options are bracketing, reducing the base rate, increasing progressivity thresholds, and then reduced progressivity rates, and then also capping progressivity. And we'll come back to each of these, either today or subsequently in analysis. Advantages: that does not require increased complexity of the fiscal structure. And we're making a specific point about that because the more complex the fiscal structure, the greater the administrative capacity or apparatus has to be to manage that. Generally, if I may add, generally, more complex fiscal structures are not an advantage to governments. What usually happens in our global experience is that the companies will always invest in what they need to understand the complexity of the fiscal terms that they're in because they are going to understand how to make money in them. And generally, their capacity to understand and manage their side of a complex fiscal regime is usually better than the government side in terms of their capacity to administer to a complex regime. So this is a constant concern of ours just from our global practice. Other advantages, again, it may present opportunities for simplification as well. Disadvantage, if it ends up incentivizing new high-cost resources to this method alone, if that requires, it could require giving back substantial rent to the producers on the mature producing assets. So while it could work in of itself, for incenting the new higher cost projects, which would help lower the decline rate or maybe even reverse. That alone probably, if that was done, would actually give back substantial rent to the producers on the mature producing assets. Again, that is the area of ACES and that part of the oil sector that is already profitable. So that's a disadvantage. And I'm going to go through each of these, and then I'll ask the chairman if we may have Janik make some additional comments. The second approach is, can we differentiate between the old and new production? So if we said ACES was working for the old production, if I could use that, how can I carve out or treat new production differently in some way, shape, or form? You could have an allowance for new oil, and we're going to see some assessment of that. We could switch away a little bit from the net profits taxation to a gross revenue taxation that could allow different tax rates for different production streams without overcomplicating some of the accounting issues. Or we could use some combination of definitions for incremental production over and above the base decline rate. And have the Alaskan regulator agree to where those would take place or designate what the new programs and new areas are. And again, all in the service of differentiating new production activities from old. So the advantages are it would allow significant reductions in government take on new and costly developments, including heavy oil, the viscous oil, without requiring significant reductions on the mature producing assets. So that would be an advantage. The disadvantages, from our perspective, again, were the administrative difficulties around how do you define what new production is and how do you manage that as time goes on. And that's a concern we feel. Thirdly, as an approach, can we make enhancements to the cost progressivity of ACES? And that's the third row in the table that's in front of you. Here, implementation options could include changes to allowable cost deduction or change the credits mechanism, maybe provide greater uplift for higher capital and operating cost. It could mean enhancements to royalty relief. Royalty relief could be granted on a investment by investment basis for higher cost developments, and again, separating that or changing the cost progressivity. The advantage to that would be
Maybe before you go on to the advantages, you should define uplift. We don't use that term in our structure, and just so everybody understands what an uplift is.
Uplift is. For example, if it's often part of a cost recovery mechanism or a credits mechanism. For example, if a company were to spend, let's say, $2 billion, an uplift mechanism on cost might be that for every dollar spent that they actually get tax credits or advantages worth $1.20. So that 20 cents on the dollar is an uplift on the capital so expend. You do have cost uplifts or capital uplifts in other fiscal environments. They're usually part of production sharing mechanisms, et cetera. So it means, again, to get a higher dollar amount or credit realized for each dollar of capital spent. Janik, do you want to comment further on that for the committee?
Mr. Mayor, Janik, did we lose him?
I guess it means
we'll continue
not
on.
Like to comment further on that.
Mr. Chairman, I think I may be muted at my end as well as at yours. My apologies.
The question is uplift, we're having a definition, a new term on the table, uplift, and the discussion is what is an uplift? And when is it used, and what's the advantage of it, so we understand what uplift is?
So certainly. I concur with everything my colleague Jerry Kappa says, is that uplift is simply a mechanism for, essentially, for giving greater credit through some mechanism, whether that's, for instance, the capital credit under ACES, or a cost deduction to costs that have been spent, as one mechanism of making a fiscal regime more progressive with regard to cost than it might otherwise be.
Okay. Lifelines are always hard on the telephone, but we'll do it from time to time. I don't think you needed one on there, that one, though. But
thank you.
Yeah, go ahead and go to advantages, please.
Advantages, it does not require a structural change away from ACES, and that could be perceived as an advantage. Disadvantages, it does increase already what we think is a complex structure, makes it a bit more opaque. It could exacerbate the problem of poor or indeterminate cost control incentives. And by that we mean if you grant credits and you're not precisely sure what they're being used for, then you're not getting the targeted impact of granting those credits here. It does increase the likelihood of unintended consequences. Now, that's a fairly broad statement. What we mean there is you don't want a system that rewards high-cost operators, per se, or rewards an operator who may not be as focused on cost control as others. I mean, the companies have their own reasons for cost control, but you certainly don't want a system that might not kind of penalize that, let's put it that way. So it could result in certain investments being made that would not have been made except for this. And then finally, again, we would like to do more analysis on that, but it appears to us that would have a less significant impact, or it would not be as significant an impact as the new production differentiation approach that I talked about in row number two of the table.
Okay. This will be our last slide this morning. We have a question from Senator McGuire. We may have other questions. And then it looks like a natural break to go into a comparison between the current structure and then Senate Bill 192 starting at 1 o'clock. So, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And through the chair, Mr. Chairman, you were laying out how we would conduct the hearings over this week and next week. You mentioned the fact that our consultants are available to model various amendments, including the tax holiday, and I think they already modeled B7 from the Resources Committee that I did. But if not, I just ask that it is an amendment that would make the 110 approach, essentially, of bracketing and reducing the progressivity rate, apply only to new production. And I agree that, you know, we've had difficulties trying to think about how you define that. But I just would like, at some point, when you do come back with those models, to see that model again. And any thoughts you have, advice you have about how, whether it's incremental, you know, growth in the production or how you define new development, I'd love advice.
We're going to have them do the analysis on progressivity. Bracketing, of course, is one of the discussion items, and there's at least two amendments at Resources in a multiple or an endless way we can do brackets, but we'll also be looking at the effects of slope changes, base tax adjustments as we work with that. So we are not going to just have a presentation in the direction of the bill in front of us. We're going to look at all the options and then zero in. It may be something that's already in the bill, or it may be something that we change, or it may be a whole new concept. So I've already had those discussions with PFC Energy, so that stuff will be taking place. And but at the end of the day, we need to make sure we're counting the net cash flow, so we don't, because as was referenced earlier in this presentation, we're not the most sophisticated people in this game. The producers are, so we need to make sure we understand what we're doing. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just stepping back to slide 28 rather quickly, you mentioned a renewal CapEx, and we're having a great deal of exploration going on the North Slope now. And if it takes 7 to 10 years to bring that to production, that's kind of the numbers people use, doesn't that current activity look like it was a positive, an optimistic look at the future? And with that thought in mind, the people that are doing that, how likely do you think it is that a sophisticated oil company would have made those kind of investments without understanding the existing tax system in the state of Alaska?
Thank you for the question, Senator. If I understand, we have we have new investors or new producers producing exploration activity, and so if you're asking me, did they understand the fiscal terms that they were confronted with at the time, or if I could ask for a repeat of the question?
Well, basically, with the activity we see, which is increased activity, why would we see that activity from companies that have opportunities all over the world? Sure. And now some claim that they didn't understand the tax system, had questions about it, yet still went ahead and purchased huge tracts, or at least huge tracts of land, and made significant investments. Does that seem likely to you that they would do that?
Well, I suppose not only does it seem likely, but since they have, I think in one or two cases, I do believe that at the time when they took these exploration licenses, they did not fully see through the commercial arrangements they would have to make in order to commercially develop reserves that they would find. And that is, you have a situation where, as an exploration play, and if you look at the exploration tax credits and all that, and the incentives within ACES regarding exploration, that if you look out ahead, that looks or appears to be a reasonably attractive proposition. And again, I'd say with that the comments that we're making here really are not with respect to those exploration activities. We've been kind of dealing with the here and now in terms of what's going to happen in the next 7 or 8 years. So under ACES, there were incentives and are incentives for exploration activity, and people were attracted to that. Now, the push comes to shove is when you've made a discovery, and let's say it's a 65 million barrel discovery or 80. It's going to be a lot harder to find, from a prospectivity point of view, 200 or 300 million barrel discoveries, because we are where we are in terms of the maturity of the basin. Let's say a 65 million barrel. Then how do you tie that production back into existing infrastructure? What commercial arrangements do you need to make with the existing operators of that evacuation infrastructure? And it's in some of those issues that are not always apparent when someone takes an exploration license, but when you are coming up to a final investment decision and you have to work out those commercial arrangements, those can be less attractive also. I think it can be hard when you're making that initial exploration decision to really consider what's it really going to take in terms of commercial development, given trunk line situation that we have here, the processing capacity that we have, in terms of what actually happens when you get to FID, which again is final investment decision. That can turn a 65 million barrel exploration success into a sub-marginal economic investment. And then, because we are dealing with different companies, independents as opposed to majors, they'll have different investment criteria, different things that they want to take a risk on. It's possible that a given company might decide to take a slightly lower return on a project because they believe that the potential beyond that project was such that they would be able to basically have subsequent opportunities that are more profitable. Again, that would really case by case. Can it happen that a company simply does not understand what it's getting into? Yes, that does happen. But I think that what we've had here is less understanding on what it took to be a commercial success versus an exploration success because of the access to infrastructure issue, if that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
I think we'll be going into a little bit of that in the future, too, as we move beyond the existing producers into our other areas of our tax code where we're dealing with exploration credits and other things. So. Okay, well, that concludes this morning's hearing. We're going to reconvene at 1 p.m. Sharp. We'll pick up on slide 31 and start doing the comparisons between the current tax structure and the Senate Bill 192. We are adjourned.